From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this holiday edition of Fresh Air, some two-fisted piano playing and fine singing. We feature 1998 onstage concerts and interviews with pianist, songwriter, and singer Marsha Ball and singer Tracy Nelson. Ball's music mixes the rhythms she grew up with on the Gulf Coast, Zydeco, Cajun, Rockabilly, and Boogie Woogie. Nelson became famous in the late 60s as the lead singer of the roots music band Mother Earth. Nelson and Ball each have new CDs. Ball plays on Nelson's. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews A People's History of the American Revolution, which describes the revolution through the eyes of generals, slaves, Indians, and soldiers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Choirs and bands set a patriotic tone at Independence Hall in Philadelphia this 4th of July as President Bush used the occasion to praise the work of faith-based charities, saying they demonstrate religious liberty in action.
These soldiers and the armies of compassion deserve our support. They often need our support. And by taking their side, we act in the best interests and tradition.
Mr. Bush called on Congress to enact his faith-based initiative, which would allow religious groups to compete for federal funding for social service work. The proposal has encountered opposition on Capitol Hill, where some lawmakers are concerned that it could blur the constitutional separation of church and state. Earlier, Mr. Bush and the First Lady took part in a block party. They helped paint a street mural, and Mr. Bush played quarterback briefly in a game of touch football. Also in Philadelphia today, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was presented with the city's Liberty Medal, award awarded each year to a person or group that has worked to spread freedom worldwide. From member station WHYY, Brad Linder reports.
Kofi Annan received the Liberty Medal for his work to battle HIV and AIDS and to decrease poverty in the world. On this 4th of July, in front of Independence Hall in Philadelphia, where the Declaration of Independence was signed, Annan said the pursuit of liberty is a global cause.
Though your Independence Day heralded freedom for the American people, it inspired and continues to inspire millions the world over to strive to end tyranny and defend human dignity.
Annan says the fight for liberty is hardly over. He has pledged to donate the $100,000 Liberty Medal Prize to the Global AIDS and Health Fund, which he helped create. For NPR News, I'm Brad Linder in Philadelphia.
Less than a week after firefighters contained a 14,000-acre blaze near Reno, lightning has touched off a series of new wildfires in Nevada. From member station KUNR in Reno, Brian Behuth reports.
Hundreds of lightning strikes set off a dozen brush fires in the Reno area Tuesday evening. Fires briefly burned within a half mile of suburban Reno homes, but firefighters quickly contained the blazes with the help of three air tankers, two helicopters, and hundreds of firefighters working on the ground. The biggest of the fires burned 150 acres, threatening two multi-million-dollar homes. Power was cut to affected neighborhoods, leaving more than 4,000 customers without power for nearly an hour. Power outages to traffic signals also caused motorist confusion in Reno and Carson City. Smoke-filled skies have become a regular feature this summer in northern Nevada as the driest conditions in 130 years have left the foliage in the region tinderbox dry. Afternoon thunderstorms are predicted each day for the rest of the week. For NPR News, I'm Brian Behuth in Reno.
Doctors have an optimistic prognosis for the man who received the world's first self-contained artificial heart this week. A surgeon says the man, in his 50s, had been in dire condition, but the implant may allow him to live a long and productive life. This is NPR. A rash of armed robberies at pharmacies in New England has prompted a major supermarket chain to stop carrying a powerful prescription drug painkiller, OxyContin. From member station WBUR in Boston, Jason Bobien has the story.
Over the last 2 months, gun-wielding robbers have stormed into at least six suburban drugstores in the Boston area and made off with the pharmacy's inventories of OxyContin. A single pill of the highly addictive painkiller can be worth more than $100 on the street. Sometimes the gunmen don't even bother to steal the cash out of the register. The Shaw's supermarket chain has been hit twice since May. One of the holdups was at a store in Maine. The other was in Massachusetts. A spokesman for Shaw's says that out of concern for the safety of its customers and staff, it will no longer stock OxyContin in any of its pharmacies. Customers can still special order the prescription drug. Earlier this year, Hannaford Brothers, which runs more than 100 Shop and Save supermarkets in the Northeast, announced a similar ban on the painkiller. For NPR News, I'm Jason Beaubien in Boston.
About 50 people had to be rescued from a Ferris wheel at Detroit's Comerica Park after the big wheel got stuck during a game between the Tigers and the Kansas City Royals. Firefighters used a cherry picker and a ladder to bring the people down. Israel's security cabinet has officially resumed a tactic of targeting Palestinian militants despite U.S. opposition to what Palestinian officials call an assassination campaign. Cabinet ministers said Israel will use an active defense against militants who plan or attempt to carry out attacks against Israelis. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat says the policy is a violation of the U.S. brokered ceasefire in the Middle East. The outgoing U.S. ambassador to Israel is blaming both Israel and the Palestinians for undermining peace efforts. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have a couple of roots music performances for you on this July 4th with singer Tracy Nelson and blues and boogie pianist Marshall Ball. They each have new CDs. Let's start with Marshall Ball. One of the things Austin, Texas is best known for is music, and one reason why is Marshall Ball. In Rolling Stone, she was described as playing piano with a sort of rollicking spirit that can't be taught but must be felt. Her music is steeped in the rhythms of the Gulf Coast. She grew up in Louisiana on the Texas border and has lived in Austin since the early 70s. She's made several recordings. Her new one is called Presumed Innocent. We're going to hear an interview and performance recorded in 1998 at an onstage benefit for public radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. I asked Marshall Ball to describe the small town in Louisiana in which she grew up.
Well, I kind of did in one of my songs. It's 10 blocks square. I didn't realize this until I had left because it was my whole world for 17 years. My parents kept me pretty much right there in town, although there were honky-tonks all around, and, you know, you'd go one town or another to shop or to go to a movie, but for the most part, we were in that town, and it wasn't until I had left town, and actually I was running, I was jogging one day, and I was standing on one street, and there was a sign that said Catholic Church, 8 blocks, and I thought, well, I'm on the westmost street, and that's only 2 blocks away from the eastmost street, so there's really only 10 blocks in this whole town, and that's how big it is.
Well, you have a song that I'd like you to play that I imagine is pretty autobiographical called Down the Road. And maybe you could do the song for us, and then we could talk a little bit more about that period of your life.
All right. It's an autobiography. Right. Good times are down the road. Mama won't let me go. I'm sneaking off in my daddy's car. I park behind the B&B bar. Thinking I'll go crazy if I can't get out on a dead-end street in a 10-block town. One day I'll take the coastal bend, hit the Gulf of Mexico and drive on in down the road. Start. I'm tired of six packs and driving shows and talking back to the radio. I got wheels and I'm ready to pack, but I don't know what's holding me back. Every day I say I'm gone and then every night I'm in the joints again. Down the road, down the road, down the road, down the road. Popping through the fog, a siren screaming on a one-lane street. I could hear it from my bedroom screen. Thin walls in a cheap hotel. People next door, they fighting like hell. And drinking whiskey from a paper cup. And watching TV till the sun comes up. Down the road, my feet in the lake, chewing on a chicken neck, smoking camels I stole from a pack, and watching crabs swimming in the trap, and wishing I could take the water away from Lake Charles on up to Galveston Bay, and keep on going to the open sea, wild like a wind and running free down the road. Let the good times roll down the road, let me free my soul down the road. Seems so long there's not a band there, and you know, people aren't dancing in front of you. People are actually paying attention.
Are you more used to people dancing than on a concert stage?
Yes.
How do you like the concert stage?
It makes me nervous.
Well, you sound good.
Not the thing.
So could you actually hear music coming out of the clubs from your window at home?
I lived across the street from the Catholic Hall growing up, and I had a real incredible moment of deja vu not long ago. I was in a vintage store, and I pulled this dress off the rack, and I thought, oh, God. It reminded me of Wednesday nights in the summer when you'd play outside. You're just on the cusp. You know, you'd play outside until you're just covered with grass and red bugs and little dirt necklaces and bracelets and everything. Then you'd run in, and you'd take a shower. It'd be so hot, or take a bath. You'd be so hot still, you'd still be sweating. You'd put on this was this little cotton dress with a full skirt and rickrack down the front, just like one of those dresses that we put on, and go to the dance across the street.
Huh. So did you go through a period of, when you got out of your 10-block town, of going wild?
Yeah, in a way I did. I was in, I grew up in what I really think are the best of times. You know, a childhood in the 50s in a small town, and then growing up, coming of age in the 60s and, you know, in a college. I didn't go wild enough. I mean, I didn't go to Berkeley or anything. I didn't go to San Francisco for like some people I could name. But I did go to Baton Rouge to go to college, and I was only 17 when I went. And it was just, you know, the greatest time of free love and, you know, protest politics and no diseases that you couldn't cure with penicillin and, you know, available birth control, and even the drugs weren't as strong or as dangerous as, you know, as they are now. So,
but no.
We have the best cars, we have the best music, we just had that goofy clothes, which is real popular right now.
Now, musically, my understanding is that before you started doing a lot of rhythm and blues, you were singing more, you know, quote, psychedelic music?
Yeah. Started out in a rock band.
What was your repertoire in your early rock band?
Well, I did a lot of Janis, or some Janis and some Grace Slick and some Jimi Hendrix. I sang a couple of songs. I did a Janis Ian song, and then a little bit of blues. We also, you know, Slim Harpo lived right across the river.
You said you never went to San Francisco, but you tried.
We broke down.
Tell us the story of what happened on the way to San Francisco.
Well, we got to Austin, and you know. Look at her. I know why y'all are here, too. We got here, there was a lot of interaction between Baton Rouge and Austin before I got here. To us, it really was the Third Coast. We were getting posters from the Vulcan Gas Company that looked just like the Family Dog posters and the mm-hmm. Fillmore posters that were coming from the West Coast and from New York, and there was a good music scene and already. And
did you figure out at some point that maybe there was already enough, like Grace Slick, and there was Grace Slick and Janis Joplin and a lot of people trying to be them, that maybe you were better off trying to figure out who you were?
In a way, I did, and I'll be honest with you. I used to work here at the university. This is what I did when I. That was the other reason I stayed, was that I had a friend who worked at the university and could get anybody a job in the library. So I worked here, and we would drive home, living in South Austin, same neighborhood I still live in, and we would be listening to the radio, and I guess it was probably 71 in the middle of all this, and Tracy Nelson would come on the radio. I think, damn, I can do that. That's what I want to do. So, yeah, I was already kind of moving, and, I picked up things from everybody along the way.
Would you do a few bars of a country song that you did in your country period?
I have a key here. You were mine for just a while. Now you're putting on the style. And you'll never once look back to your home across the track. You're the gossip of the town. But your heart can still be found where they tossed it on the ground. Pick me up on your way down.
That's a nice song. We'll get back to the onstage concert and interview with Marshall Ball after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the 1998 interview and performance with Marshall Ball, recorded on stage in Austin, Texas. Marshall Ball, I really love your piano playing as well as your songs and singing, and I thought we might start with the piano playing. How old were you when you started playing?
I started taking lessons when I was 5 years old.
Now, we hear the kind of music you play now. What were you learning when you were five?
Well, I started, kiddie classicals like everybody does, but I had piano players in my family. My grandmother was a ragtime piano player and kind of came out of the Tin Pan Alley generation in that era. She had a window seat full of sheet music, and so even pick out some of that and listen to her.
Now, you were born and grew up in Louisiana. What do you consider the regional rhythms or just a part of you living there?
Well, I actually was born in Orange, Texas. I want to go ahead and claim dual citizenship while I'm at it. And I grew up right across the state line in Vinton, Louisiana. And I don't accept that border. I don't give credence to that as the Sabine River as being a border.
We are given this choice when we're born in this country to just ignore the borders.
I think that the Gulf Coast is a region and, could be considered a state. The rhythm is, my favorite is the old 6/8, You gave me love when there was none. Matilda, that's a Matilda, you're the only one. The Gulf Coast 6/8 soul sound.
What else do you consider unique to?
We had a lot of Zydeco and Cajun music, Well, my sister got married at a very early age. Mama got her ready for a wedding day. Everybody came to see the beautiful bride. Like that, a good Cajun two-step, waltzes. Jolie Blanc type waltzes, and then the Zydeco.
Did you have teachers who taught you this, or did you just pick it up from listening to records?
No, and I picked up most of this as an adult, really, as a piano player in bands. I grew up, listening to How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? And how my grandmother played.
Did they encourage you or discourage you or none of the above from playing rhythm and blues?
Well, that came later, I guess. You know, I loved to boogie woogie from the first time that I could hear that. I, you know, was trying to make my hands go the octave so I could, so I could try to do the octave into stride. And they didn't discourage me. I could always get out of doing housework by playing the piano.
So when you started playing rhythm and blues and seeking out more material, did you find songs that you felt comfortable with?
Yeah, there's a wealth of material. I'm still amazed. I was talking to Tracy earlier about songs that I've dropped from my repertoire, mm-hmm. some things that I've never recorded, but just great songs that I don't do anymore just because, you know, you replace them with something else, but then you're thinking, it's Ease the Pain, that was the name of it, and I think it's Jackie Wilson. And it does. It's not a gender thing. We were also complaining about how, you know, sometimes when you're looking for a song, somebody say, "Well, you can't do that. That's a man's song."
Well, another thing though,
your pardon.
Well, particularly in some blues and rhythm and blues songs, there's some songs that just sound really pretty sexist, and they were written, I think, in a time before people thought about that a whole lot. And I think you've kind of turned that on its ear a little bit. Like you do a lot of the double entendre songs that other people have written, and you even came up with one of your own. And before you play the one that you wrote, talk a little bit about why you like doing songs like that. The songs that are double entendres about sex that don't come out and say it, but just tease about it a lot.
Well, it's just fun. And, one, you know, it's all about, in a way, you know, a lot of blues is, and I don't even get approached the old Jelly Roll type songs, you know. I've got a stack of CDs of old stuff. And that was one of the reasons when I did Let Me Play With Your Poodle. And I thought, you know, take it any way you want. But this record was released in 1942. And if they could take it, then I think we probably could too. And instead, I just get lots of pictures of people's poodles.
Why don't you play us the song that you wrote?
Okay. It's called The Right Tool for the Job. And I want to send... I'm going to send it out to my husband, who thinks a screwdriver is a special tool. When I go to eat my dinner, I reach for my spoon and fork. It's time to cut my steak, I make sure my knife is sharp. And when I want to hang a picture, I reach for a hammer and nail. And if I've got to clean the floor, I get out the mopping pail. I don't like to waste my time, I make sure I've got the right tool for the job. The right tool for the job. The right tool. I want a car that goes real fast. And when I listen to music, I want the radio to blast. And if my house is burning down, get the fire truck real quick and take me to the finest doctor, y'all, if I start to feeling sick. I want an icebox that stays cold, a stove that gets real hot, the right tool for the job. The right tool for the job. Job. sticks, a razor blade that never nicks. I want a fan that keeps me cool at night, a hum that always loves me right. The right tool for the job. The right tool for the job.
Marsha, would you explain the lyric to me? No. Marsha Ball recorded on stage in 1998 in Austin, Texas, at a benefit for public radio station KUT. Ball has a new CD called Presumed Innocent. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Rose Grower by Michel de Kretzer, a novel about France during the Reign of Terror and the cultivation of roses. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tracy Nelson became known in the 60s as the lead singer of the roots music group Mother Earth. Coming up, Nelson talks about her life and sings accompanied by pianist Marsha Ball. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new book, A People's History of the American Revolution. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tracy Nelson is a powerful singer who became famous in the late 60s as the lead singer of the group Mother Earth. Over the past few years, she's recorded a series of albums featuring a blend of country, soul, and rhythm and blues. Her new CD is called Ebony and Irony. The 1973 Mother Earth album, Poor Man's Paradise, is scheduled to be reissued by the British label Acadia later this month. Here's a track from the record.
Thank you.
I hosted a Tracy Nelson interview and performance in Austin, Texas in 1998. It was a benefit for public station KUT. Accompanying Nelson at the piano was Marsha Ball, who we heard from earlier in today's show. Tracy Nelson grew up in Wisconsin and loved rhythm and blues. She told me she had trouble finding like-minded musicians when she moved to San Francisco in the 60s.
Because that was the psychedelic era. And nobody, you know, they'd say, what kind of music do you like? And I'd say, well, I kind of like blues. They'd say, oh, I'll go hear this blues band at the Matrix. They're really great. And it'd be the Grateful Dead. And when I was in Wisconsin, I went every weekend to Chicago and heard Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. And, you know, that's what I meant when I said blues, and wasn't really what they were doing out there. And R&B was just out of the question. It was just nobody doing R&B.
Now, you had already recorded an album, I think, by the time you got to San Francisco. You had an album in 1965.
Yeah.
And what? How did you, I think you were still in college, how did you manage to get a record so young?
Well, it was like everything else that's ever happened in my career. I don't know, it was a fluke. I was at a party, met a guy, liked my singing, and said, let's, you know, we can do a record.
Who'd you meet?
Sam Charters.
Well, he's not just a guy. I mean, Sam Charters has produced a zillion blues records and written books about the blues and, you know, traveled the South rediscovering blues musicians.
It really had to do, I was at that time doing some kind of folky stuff with Johnny Kalb, who was Danny Kalb's brother, who was in the original Blues Project. And they came through town, Danny was doing a show, and then we went to a party afterwards and sat around and sang. And Sam seemed to think that I could do something, so... And that was a very acoustic, kind of traditional blues thing.
How did you find the musicians in the band that you formed, Mother Earth?
Well, Doug's going to kill me for this. He's going to kill me. But, I mean, this is the absolute truth. We looked everywhere for musicians. And the man who was kind of acting as my manager then and was my manager for years, Travis Rivers, came to us one day and he said, it was me and another singer and a keyboard player, so I found a great R&B section writer. They're great. They're from South Texas. They're just what you want. And I said, well, how'd you find these guys? He said, well, it's Doug Somm's band. And I said, well, isn't Doug going to be kind of nerked off if we just take his whole rhythm section? And Travis said, screw him. He just ran off with my wife. That's the absolute truth.
So what has Doug Somm's reaction since then been?
He asked me not to tell that story.
I guess we'll leave it there.
Yeah. Oh, and so, we definitely got the better end of that deal. There's no deal.
Now, the the person who you mentioned, Travis, who was your manager, uh-huh. Now, he was also, I believe, the person who... you know, discovered Janis Joplin.
Well, he didn't really discover her, but they were kind of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And
friends in the 60s term?
Yeah. And he brought her up to San Francisco from Texas originally, but that didn't last long.
So was there ever the suggestion that you were being marketed as, like, the next Janis Joplin?
It worked in my favor to a large degree because I was nobody. I mean, I had just threw some people together and I was doing a kind of music that nobody was really doing out there. And thanks to Bill Graham, we actually got some gigs, but still, we'd play and people would say, oh, yeah, that's okay, but you're no Janis. But the record companies were all of them looking for another Janis, the next Janis, their Janis. And for Mercury, who gave me my first contract, very quickly, I mean, within a year or so after I moved out there, I had a record contract, which was absurd. And that was their hope, and I think they were bitterly disappointed.
Well, you're so different than, I mean, yeah, she was really such a kind of shouter singer, whereas you're a singer. I mean, not which isn't to put Janis Joplin down in any way, but, I mean...
It's apples and oranges for sure.
Yeah,
and I never heard
different.
Any similarities at all. But I understand why they thought I could be that because I'm loud. So.
Well, did that also give you the sense that you were supposed to be this kind of like like sexual figure of fantasy in the way that she was, that you were supposed to have this like erotic relationship with the audience the way she did? Because she really did. I mean, that was her thing, having this like erotic relationship with the audience. Yeah. And that's a lot of like, oh, you're the next Janis, so you got to get on stage and do that too.
You know, I didn't think about that much at the time.
That's
and
just
glad
as well,
I didn't.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I did that never crossed my mind. I'm sure you're right. I'm sure that that was part of the expectation, but again, people were bitterly disappointed.
The band was named Mother Earth, and it was named after a Memphis Slim song that was a song that the band did. Let me ask you to do a few bars of the song.
Yeah, okay. Well, you can hi-hat me all the time, and you may never come my way. Mother Earth is waiting for you. There's a debt you've got to pay. I don't care how rich you are. I don't care. Got to go back to Mother.
This song is, of course, about how we all end up dead and in the ground, but did people somehow interpret it that as Tracy Nelson is an Earth Mother?
Yeah. And it really, you know, when you start a band, you work up shuffles and slow blues because it doesn't take any rehearsal at all. And you want to get out there and do a gig as quick as you can, so you don't want to waste a lot of time rehearsing. So you just work together a blues set. And so this is one of the first things we pulled in, and one of the guys in the band, and I'm sure they came to regret it, said, oh, this would be a great, you know, band name. Immediately it drew attention to me being the only woman in the group, and just detracted from them. And there was another singer, Paul St. John, who was a brilliant, brilliant writer and a wonderful singer. And, you know, he got kind of eclipsed with that. And people started thinking I was like Mother Earth. And, you know, that's a heavy burden. And one I never asked for. And when people would come to my house and think I had a commune, and when I moved to Tennessee and lived on a farm, I would get up in the morning, there'd be people in my living room saying, oh, we're here to crash in your commune. And it did carry a lot of baggage with it.
We'll return to our onstage performance and interview with Tracy Nelson after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the 1998 interview and performance with Tracy Nelson, featuring Marshall Ball at the piano. You left San Francisco for Nashville in sometime in the 70s.
69,
okay. Yeah. And so did that change your music? Did that lead you more toward country music?
I don't think so. I'd always sort of liked a little bit of country music. It was confusing. It probably put a kind of a stop to my career at
Why?
That point. Because I moved to Nashville, my records said, you know, recorded in Nashville. They went in the country bins. People, would, if they even bought them, would say, well, she don't sound country. And, you know, it just confused people. And it about the time we had finally gotten enough attention to, you know, what I was doing and re-educated people, then I did that damn duet with Willie Nelson, with that damn Willie Nelson. Which is probably the single most successful thing I've ever done in my life, and I mean it was a great song, but we just did it as a whim, and it was huge on the country charts. So that just confused it all over again, and from that point on, I've been, you know, you don't hear me describe without country being in there It did confuse the issue pretty much.
But you have recorded a bunch of country songs.
Oh, yeah, and right after I moved to Nashville, I did an entire album of country tunes, so that probably probably pushed it right along, too.
Well,
go figure.
Just to show off that part of your repertoire, maybe Marcia can come back to the piano and accompany you in maybe a few bars of a country song that you like.
Yeah. Actually, a song I used to do in my folk act was I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, and then we cut it on that. You hear that lonesome whippoorwill? He sighs to blue fly. The midnight train is moaning low. I'm so that line, have you ever heard a robin sob? I mean, God, what a line.
I'd like to ask you to do another song from the Mother Earth era. And this is a song you wrote. It's a great song, and you sing it so well. And it's called Down So Low. And I know you've sung this a lot over the years, but I'd love to hear you sing it.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't usually do it. I mean, I usually have like a whole band with me to do it, and that's easier for me. When you went away, I cried for so long, and I wanted you. Just can't find another man.
you know I love you. But that wasn't enough.
A nice big drum crash.
What was going through your life when you wrote that song?
That's what I call one of my bad boyfriend songs. I mean, you know, what the hell do you think? I was in love with a guitar player who became quite famous, and he broke my heart, and I wrote this song, and it's the best thing he ever did. Musically, anyway.
Tracy Nelson recorded in Austin, Texas in 1998 at a benefit for public radio station KUT. Nelson has a new CD called Ebony and Irony. The 1973 Mother Earth album, Poor Man's Paradise, will be reissued later this month by the British label Acadia. Our thanks to Roland Morehouse and engineer Dana Whitehair. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews A People's History of the American Revolution. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. In the introduction to his new book, A People's History of the American Revolution, Ray Raphael promises to illuminate the real people, not paper heroes, who made and endured the American Revolution. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says the bright light Raphael shines on the common folk of the colonial era isn't always flattering.
I wanted to read about the American Revolution for a long time, but Ray Raphael's new book, A People's History of the American Revolution, wasn't exactly what I had in mind. Instead of visions of yeoman farmers clasping copies of Tom Paine's Common Sense to their bosoms as they rose up against British tyranny, Raphael's book has left me with troubling images of legions of lice-infested teenagers, most of them signing up to join the Continental Army because they were too poor to entertain other options. Ethan Allen, it turns out, was a swaggering ruffian, the kind of bully who threatened judges by stripping naked in court and cursing. His famed Green Mountain Boys were originally formed as a vigilante property owners association. It's a good thing Raphael's People's History focuses on what he calls the rank and file rebels, as opposed to the founding fathers. Otherwise, I'd have no illusions about them left either. I'd probably find out something awful, like that Thomas Jefferson slept with his slaves. Revisionist history written from the bottom up is nothing new. In fact, Raphael's book is part of a projected series of people's histories whose overall editor, historian Howard Zinn, helped to, in his own words, turn history on its head with his book, A People's History of the United States, which encapsulated the work of the post-1960s generation of historians. But there's revisionist history, and then there's really revisionist history. In a recent cover story for The New Republic, historian Sean Wilentz criticized what he referred to as David McCullough's biographical Valentine to John Adams and disparaged documentarian Ken Burns and others who used the techniques of revisionist history, multi-voiced accounts that include women, people of color, and the lower classes, to produce what Wilentz called a passive, nostalgic spectacle. Raphael, in contrast, is relentlessly aggressive and unsentimental. He takes the traditional narrative of the American Revolution and shatters it into rough and contradictory but mesmerizing fragments. If a PBS documentary were ever made of Raphael's book, exploding cannons and heated arguments rather than soothing fiddles would have to provide the soundtrack. For this contentious history, Raphael draws on letters, diaries, and testimonies left behind by runaway slaves, Native Americans, and ordinary soldiers, like Joseph Martin, a Connecticut farm boy who recorded the conditions at the Battle of White Plains in the fall of 1776. To have to lie, as I did almost every night, on the cold and often wet ground, without a blanket, and with nothing but thin summer clothing, was tedious. In the morning, the ground would often be white as snow with hoar frost. All that could be done was to lie down, if one could lie down, take our musket in our arms, and place the lock between our thighs, and weather it out. Some of the most unsettling sections of Raphael's book deal with the experiences of lower-class women during the Revolution. As Raphael points out, a fair amount of scholarship has been devoted to things like the patriotic spinning circles sponsored by the ladies of Philadelphia and Boston. But historians, he says, have largely ignored the lives of illiterate women, like the camp followers of the Continental Army, who often with children in tow, cooked and laundered for the soldiers and nursed the sick. For decades after the war, these women, together with the widows of ordinary soldiers, were denied army pensions. And Raphael ferrets out the scant testimonies of the victims of rape, mostly women and girls without social standing, who were considered fair game by both British and American soldiers. The voices of the dead that speak in A People's History of the American Revolution really bring to life the message that the Revolution was a civil war, fought by people for a host of reasons, some noble, some self-serving. But in addition to the voices Raphael calls up, the numbers he quotes have a mournful eloquence all their own. More than 25,000 soldiers are estimated to have died on the American side during the Revolution. And since roughly 50% of the population then was under the age of 16, teenagers, and especially poor teenagers, constituted a disproportionately high share of the men who fought and died. Those figures really changed the pictures I once had in my head of Valley Forge and Yorktown Heights. Raphael's vivid fragments of our nation's founding generation never quite come together into an overarching synthetic account of the political implications and motivations of the revolution. But the nervy energy of this people's history is an arresting antidote to the air of self-satisfied triumphalism that so many Americans casually assume each July 4th. Things weren't so easy on July 4th, 1776, inside or outside of Independence Hall.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A People's History of the American Revolution by Ray Raphael. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Chris Fraley and Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a novel about a woman whose husband drops dead the day after she says to him in anger, "Why don't you just die?" We talk with Carol Muskie Dukes about her book, Life After Death. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.